Today, we're talking about powerful birds of prey from the Pleistocene with expert Dr. Ellen Maper. Ellen tells us about Australia's first ever species of vulture, Cryptogyps lacertosus, crawling through caves to find fossils, uncovering the gigantic extinct eagle, Dinotoetus gaffi, and an unexpected second species of Aussie eagle. Pals in Paleo presents Fossil Vultures and Eagles with Dr. Ellen Maper. Let's go back. This is Pals in Paleo, your favourite fossil podcast filled with facts on the form, function and family groupings of extinct organisms. I'm your host, paleontologist, PhD student Adele Pentland. You can keep up to date with the show by following us on Instagram at Pals in Paleo, which is all one word. Pals in Paleo acknowledges country and the traditional custodians of the land throughout Australia and recognises First Nations people as the original scientists, engineers and technologists of this land. We recognise their connections to land, sky, water and community and pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging, especially the Eastern Kulin Nations on whose land this episode was recorded. This episode was recorded with the assistance of the Museums Victoria Conservation Department, and the holotype and only known specimen of Cryptogyps lacertosus is known from the traditional lands of the Bawandik people. This episode, we also discuss fossils of Dinotoetus, which is known from the traditional lands of the Gunai Kurnai people, whose custodianship includes Wellington Caves. Dinotoetus fossils also come from Mayor's Cave, part of the Limestone Coast, and we acknowledge the connection between the traditional custodians of the Limestone Coast, including the Miantang, Potawitch, Wunganditch, Tangani, and Narangiri language groups. Fossils of Dinotoetus gaffi and Dinotoetus pachyosteus are known from Narracourt Caves, located between the ancestral lands of the Potawitch to the north, Dudwadjali to the east, Bawandik to the south, and Miantang to the west. We recognise that sovereignty was never ceded. This was and always will be Aboriginal land. Today on the show, we are talking about not one, not two, but three extinct species of predatory birds with Dr. Ellen Maper. But before we get into all of that, it wouldn't be an episode of Pals in Paleo without first hearing a random fossil fact for crying out, Glavin. Today's random fossil fact is that some fossils are, in fact, radioactive. Now, this came up in conversation when I was chatting with a future guest who works as a curator. And I gotta say, my mind was blown when they mentioned this, because I honestly don't remember ever being taught this at school. Fossilization works in mysterious ways, and each fossil is absolutely unique. Even for a particular region or a specific geologic formation, fossils can look totally different, and I can't write down a chemical formula for this process. But as a general rule of thumb, the fossilization process gets started and kicks off when something organic, so something that was living, gets buried in an anoxic environment. So anoxic means without oxygen, so normally it's a really quick process. And then once that happens, the rocks surrounding the fossil interact with it and they sort of swap material. This can concentrate elements inside the fossil, including things like uranium, which is super radioactive. To test this, you can wave a Geiger counter over a fossil, something that is specifically made to measure radioactivity. And if it starts making a whole bunch of funny noises, Francie, can we get some Geiger counter noise? Thank you, Francie. So yeah, that's kind of what it sounds like. Now, unless you're standing next to a radioactive fossil all day long, I wouldn't worry about short-term exposure impacting your health, but it does mean that some fossils can't be displayed with other objects or specimens because the radioactivity will actually leak out and affect the stuff around them permanently. Now, this isn't just hearsay. I did my due diligence and I found a few papers on Google Scholar that support the science of this random fossil fact, and that'll be up in the show notes if you want to read more. But if you work as a curator or with fossils on a regular basis, maybe just swing a Geiger counter over your specimens real quick, because knowledge is power, and then you can go from there. If, however, you're a fossil fan and a gremlin when it comes to museums and seeing specimens on the weekend, I wouldn't worry too much about coming into contact with radioactive fossils. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but if your exposure time is short and you've only come into contact with a radioactive fossil or even a radioactive mineral, for example, over a short amount of time, I'd say it wouldn't be any worse than getting a medical scan and you'll be fine in the long term. With that, let's now shift gears and talk about something completely different. Let's get into our interview and hear about extinct eagles and vultures from Australian avian expert, Dr. Ellen Mather.
This is Pals in Paleo, the show where we get to chat about extinct animals and learn about what their anatomy can tell us about how they lived. Our special guest for today's episode is Dr. Ellen Mather from Flinders University, and it doesn't really get any cooler than eagles and vultures. So thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, a lot of the time I do ask how people got into paleo, but since you work on birds, I'm actually going to take a detour and ask, are you into bird watching, like living birds?
Well, it's not something I do regularly, but on the times I've had the opportunity, I've quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm starting to get into it. And then I'm not really good with bird IDs, but I've seen a bird carrying a live snake. And then it's always interesting when a bird goes past and it's got like nest building material as well. So even if I can't get the ID right, which is kind of ironic because I focus heavily on identifying fossils. But yeah, so you're based at Flinders. Do you want to describe what your role is with Flinders?
So currently at Flinders, I'm an adjunct academic, which has allowed me to stay on to essentially get all the research from my PhD published as papers. So that's what I've been focused on for the last almost 2 years now. And the last paper actually came out not long ago.
It was like less than a week ago.
Yeah, just. That was just over a week ago.
Yeah, which was on vultures, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But yeah, that's awesome that they've been able to keep you on and that you can take your thesis and the work that you did and share it with the world. That's incredible. So you did your PhD at Flinders.
Yes.
Did you also do your undergrad there as well?
No. So I actually did my undergrad at the University of Adelaide. And that's because at the time, Flinders didn't have a paleontology degree. So the closest there was in South Australia was the evolutionary biology degree that the University of Adelaide offered, which had a paleontology major. So I chose to do that. And after I finished my undergrad, I went up to Flinders University to do my honours, which was on fossil rails, so Raleigh from New Zealand.
Yeah. Are they flightless birds?
So they're not all flightless, but they do have a strong tendency to become flightless.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of island-dwelling species that very rapidly become flightless. So they're primarily living near water. So you'll often see they're those long-legged birds. So typically a lot of them have these little sort of like shield-like structure on their head. So the things like moorhens and coots. So you might see them hanging amongst the reeds near the water's edge.
Yep. So what was it like doing your honours on that group?
So that was actually interesting because I was focused on trying to determine the number of species present amongst these specimens we had from the site, which was St. Baffin's. So it was mostly based on size and morphology. So we were able to identify two species, one of which was, you know, quite common and quite small, and another which was larger and rarer. And so I think that work has actually been elaborated on since by Jacob Lachlan, who's also at Flinders University. And I think he found actually a third species from the site, though don't quote me on that. You might want to talk to him.
Might try and track him down, yeah. I actually had the good fortune of bumping into Jacob. We did a night walk on Saturday night looking for marsupials.
Nice.
And yeah, it was interesting because it wasn't really the right time of day to be looking for birds, but I think he saw some fairy wrens and stuff, but that would have been at like 7. So not the best time to be looking for birds. And then, yeah, you've transitioned from rails into these bigger birds of prey.
Yeah.
When you were a kid, though, did you want to be a paleontologist? Because it sounds like you kind of sought out a specific degree at uni.
Yeah, I was one of those kids who always wanted to be a paleontologist. So, you know, you start out with dinosaurs and then you learn, oh, there's more extinct things than just dinosaurs. There's a whole range of different things. So like you learn about megafauna, you learn about things that lived before the dinosaurs, and they're just so fascinating. You want to learn more about them.
Yeah, Dr. Alice Clement has mentioned this before, but Australia is really unique because there's like a really broad cross-section of life. There's the early squishies, no bone zone, and then the megafauna, which has sort of become a bit of your bread and butter as well, I suppose. Mm. And then we have some dinosaurs. We're getting there, but we're certainly not competing with North America, no. I guess, in terms of like how many dinosaurs we find and stuff like that. But did you work on birds and rails and stuff because the project was available at the time, or was there something about birds that attracted you?
So at the time, the paleontology lab had a few different projects, and I was sort of in discussions with several of the professors at Flinders Paleontology. So there was John Long, who works with fish, and then Gavin Prideaux working with marsupials, and Trevor Worthy, who works with birds. So I ended up going with Trevor's project on the rails. I think that was the one that most appealed to me in terms of what it offered.
What sort of age bracket are we dealing with? Is it sort of thousands, or is it more millions of years old?
So most of the species I work with are from the late Pleistocene. So they sort of range between the hundreds of thousands to tens of thousands of years old.
Okay. Sorry if this sounds like a little bit patronizing, but like to me, that's so recent because most of the stuff I work on is like 100 million.
Yeah, well, it is. And I think that's part of what makes it so interesting, because this is stuff that from a geological perspective just died out practically yesterday. So back then, you know, all our modern fauna would have been present. And it's just that there's been essentially this mass extinction that's acted as a filter. And what we have today is what was around back then, minus all these species that just didn't survive.
Yeah, it's pretty eye-opening, I think, for people who have seen your most recent paper to be like, oh, Australia had vultures and now we don't. And this has kind of come up as well when I've chatted to other folks, like there was a type of flamingo in Australia. There were like freshwater dolphins and stuff. Mm. And they didn't go extinct like that long ago. But those groups in particular, they're pretty charismatic. So if they were around today, everyone would know that we had them in Australia. But yeah, it's also things like I'm obsessed with collecting yowies. And yeah, it might have been Kayla Thorne who mentioned the flamingos. And then I was like going through some stuff and I'm like, oh yeah, there's a flamingo yowie for it. My dream is to try and have extinct fossils of yowies again. Like we'll have to have the eagle that you've done, the vulture as well. Which one do we talk about first?
Pals and Paleo will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Dinosaur Trips. Dinosaur trips are exactly what they sound like. Each itinerary gets you up close and personal with experts and gives you backstage access into the world of paleontology, visiting museums from across the world, and even getting you onto real-life dinosaur digs. There's a bunch of trips running in 2024. Alberta Badlands and Beyond is back, and so's Badlands Family Adventure. Personally, I'm eyeing off the trip to Arizona and California because I'm dying to see the La Brea tar pits. But then again, I'm also tempted to travel to Patagonia. To learn more about the 2024 trips, you can check out their website, dinosaurtrips.com, and sign up to their newsletter to be the first to find out about the new trips. And you can email Zach on zach@dinosaurtrips.com, and Zach is spelled Z-A-C-H. It's been 66 million years. Why wait any longer? Join Dinosaur Trips on the adventure of a lifetime.
Well, we could go in order of publication, in which case the vulture comes first.
Yeah, sure. An Australian vulture, like, were there more as well, or is this the first one?
Yeah, so the story of the Australian vulture is actually quite interesting because the type specimen was actually described in 1905 by Charles Walter DeVee. So he was a naturalist at the Queensland Museum, and he believed it to be an eagle, and he described it as such. So probably he didn't quite have all the comparative material on hand, or he might have been more restricting his comparisons to species in Australia at the time. So it might not have occurred to him to check if it was a vulture. The first suggestions of vultures in Australia actually came about during the 80s, I believe, with paleontologists like Gerald Van Tetz and Pat Vickers-Rich. And Gerald Van Tetz actually outright suggested that he thought that this species, which was at the time called Taphetus lacertosus, was actually a vulture. Now, it wasn't until 2022 that my paper came out, which was based on my PhD research, which was able to show definitively that, yes, this species is a vulture. And so we ended up renaming it for reasons technically unrelated to it being a vulture and more due to the original name violating taxonomic rules.
Oh, okay. I was thinking about, and this happens as well. So was the name preoccupied and already taken up by something?
David did something funny. So he used the name Taphaetis twice. So the first time around, he synonymized it with Euroatis, which is today called Aquila.
Okay.
And so then he used it again for this species, but I guess he wasn't as up to date on the rules, or maybe the rules were different back then because you can't do that.
You can't have a double up on a genus.
No.
Okay. When you started saying it violated rules, I was thinking, oh, like 1905, no internet, like maybe couldn't do like a Google and see, like, you know, just check ZooBank or whatever to see if it was there. No, it was his own work.
Yeah.
The double up. That's okay. That's wild. But
I guess he really liked the name, perhaps.
He liked it so much, he used it twice. That is cool that you got to sort of rename it, and it kind of coincides with it having the second life, not as a type of eagle, but as a type of vulture. And another thing to consider with naming fossils is sometimes if the name like integrates what group it's part of, and then it's shown later to not be in that group.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a tricky one.
Yeah. Yeah, so we ended up giving it the name Cryptogyps. So Cryptogyps.
Oh, that's
lysotosis.
So good. Because yeah. Crypto, obviously, like hidden.
Yes. And so, yeah, so the main reason behind the name was, of course, hidden vulture, because it had been in plain sight for so long. There's also like a bit of double meaning, because the original name Taphaetis essentially refers to taphonomy, and so essentially buried eagle or grave eagle.
Oh.
And so a bit of a double meaning with Cryptogyps, because, you know, a crypt is essentially an underground burial space. Mm. And that also links back to where a lot of these fossils are found. So
where are they found?
So quite a few of them have actually come from cave deposits.
Okay.
So the original specimen came from the Warburton River locality. So that's up in the north of South Australia.
So were the animals living around the cave and then they fell in? Or do you think something got them and then brought them into the cave?
So we haven't really found evidence of predation on these bones. So I think it might be that in some of these cases, the vulture was going down into the cave while it was alive. So perhaps it was flying overhead and it was just at the right angle to see a dead or dying animal down on the cave floor. And perhaps the shape of the cave entrance was sufficient for the vulture to fly down, but then
it couldn't get back out
again, because of course, birds, especially large birds, can't just do a vertical takeoff. They need a certain amount of space to fly up and out of places. And that's much more awkward if you're a big bird.
Yeah. I did want to ask, just because I'm like, oh, but they can fly, because there are some caves, I suppose, where lots of terrestrial animals have fallen in and they can't get back out.
Yeah, you could almost consider it a similar principle to sites such as the Libri tar pits, but much less effective, because of course caves are mostly closed off to the air, whereas sites like tar pits are open to the air and obviously are very natural attractant to birds of prey.
Yeah, and with cave stuff as well, so would your stuff be considered like sub-fossil if it's not getting buried? Or
It does tend to get buried in a lot of these caves.
Okay.
So sediment does accumulate over time, so you do have to dig down to get it out. Most of it would qualify as fossil material.
Okay, cool. I haven't really dealt or know anything about stuff that's on the scale of sort of tens of thousands of years, and I'm not sure about the rules, my air quotes that no one can see because this is a podcast, of like sub-fossil stuff. So that was your first vulture.
Currently the only vulture we have known from Australia, but it would surprise me if it was the only one, because vultures today, you don't find just one species in an area.
Yeah. And then normally they have like different sort of body sizes from what I work out. And then there's a pecking order of like who comes in and gets a carcass at what point and stuff.
Yeah. In fact, they're actually classified into different feeding groups based on, you know, shape of the beak and just how they feed. So there's scrapper vultures who prefer feeding on the bits of flesh that are sort of falling off the bone. So those are typically like the little vultures, like the Egyptian vulture or the hooded vulture from Africa, I believe mostly. And then there's your gulpers, which are vultures that essentially prefer to feed on the softer viscera within a carcass. So they'll be reaching all the way in to get access to it.
And they would have like mainly bald heads because they're going in. They don't want feathers getting matted by gunk.
Yeah. And then we have what we call the rippers, which are essentially the ones who have the really strong beaks to essentially pull off the tougher skin and muscle from the surface of the carcass.
Yeah. And then across those different, I guess, sort of like feeding groups, are there some that also ingest bone as
well? There is actually a vulture that ingests bone. So that's the bearded vulture. Oh, so also known as the ossifrange for that very reason. So it's actually quite specialized to feed on bone and bone marrow.
Yeah. I think I would have heard about it from another podcast called Just the Zoo of Us. So is it possible to sort of work out how your vulture would have eaten anything like that? Or maybe a better question would be, what's the holotype specimen?
So the holotype specimen is still the specimen the V described, which is a distal humerus.
Okay.
And we also have specimens of the tarsal metatarsus. So that's in birds, that's the lower foot bone. So
kind of the toes they fuse together.
Yeah,
so and then the distal end of the humerus, that'd be like the bottom end of the biggest bone in the arm on us.
Yeah, so humans, of course, don't have a tarsal metatarsus.
No.
We've got all these tarsals in our foot. And so basically in birds, these are all fused together into a single bone. I think it's to make it more structurally sound.
Yeah, it looks a bit more solid. And once you get your eye in, you kind of pick up how it's different. Because I guess it looks like any long bone, but then you have, I guess, like three knobs that kind of come out at the end.
Yeah, so those are the trochlea, which the toes are attached to.
Yep.
Yep. And then we also have quite a few more wing bones from a site. So we've got the ulna and radius.
So lower arm bones.
Yep. The carpus metacarpus, which is
I guess it's weird to say a bird has a wrist.
Yes. It's kind of the same deal as the tarsal metatarsus, except for the hand.
Oh, okay. That's a good analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a few others. So we also have the scapula, so one of the shoulder bones, and the coracoid, which again is related to the shoulder girdle.
Yeah. And we humans don't have a coracoid anymore.
And I believe we also have a vertebra and one of the toe bones, so specifically for the back toe.
Oh, okay. Yep. So again, I guess this is pretty typical for bird fossils because their bones were hollow?
Yeah. So some of the long bones preserve better than others, I think. So you'll often get carpus metacarpus or the ulnae. It seems like there's often a lot of breakage around the humerus or in the legs, the tibiotarsus. So you'll often find the further distal along the limb you get. So the further outwards from the body, the more intact the bones seem to be. So I don't know if that's in some species anyway, that might be related to predation, like an animal's gone and chomped on the bird and just swallowed most of the main body, but let the wings drop.
Oh, yeah, they want. Okay, that makes sense. Because sorry to cut you off, but in some sites with our sauropods, we really have struggled to find the tail until recent years because that was a piece they could get like isolate from the rest of the carcass and maybe drag away and then the big bones would be left behind. But I totally get what you're saying now with the birds and that, no, they want the meaty bits, but then there's not a lot of meat around the wings and the legs. So they'll leave that and they're going, yeah, as you said, for like more than torso area because that's where the meat is.
Yes. So that's probably the case of a lot of the smaller birds, not necessarily with, you know, the bigger ones, especially if you're birds of prey. But yeah, there does seem to be.
So no signs of like scavenging or bite marks or anything on any of the bones you've looked at?
None so far. So currently we lack skull material for cryptogyps, which is a pain because that could tell us a lot about how it might have fed, so which feeding category it fell into. But I think based on its size, so actually funny thing about its size, it's actually quite small compared to a lot of modern vultures. So it was.
Have we talked about how big it was?
No, we haven't.
Okay.
So I think size-wise, it was similar to a wedge-tailed eagle, maybe slightly smaller, but compared to a lot of vultures, that's actually quite small. So
a wedge-tailed eagle, it has like a wingspan of, is it like 2.5 meters?
Yeah, I think sometimes up to 3 meters.
Hey, it's Adele. I just wanted to butt in and do a quick size conversion for you. So if wedge-tailed eagles, which scientific name is Aquila audax, if they have wingspans up to 2.5 meters, that's equivalent to 8.2 feet, which is a bit bigger than a king-size bed. Anyway, back to the episode and back to the size estimates of Cryptogyps lassitosis.
Now, it's not the smallest vulture, so some of the really small ones would be about half that size again.
Wow.
So those are the little scrappers.
Yep.
So probably it would have been either a gulper or maybe a ripper, depending on its skull morphology and if it had a strong enough beak, that kind of work.
And when it was alive, there would have been a few different things on the menu for it, presumably.
Yeah.
Kangaroos. Obviously, Australia has quite a lot of kangaroos, but yeah, megafauna times.
Yeah. So there were a lot of large marsupials around back then, especially Diprotodon comes to mind, as well as a lot of the other diprotodontids and giant kangaroos that would have provided plenty of carcasses that a vulture could feed on.
And joeys as well, like a few young and stuff. Yeah, we've sort of speculated about function and form, trying to flesh out the animal as best we can. Are you able to work out how it relates to other vultures based on the fossils you have?
Yeah, so actually part of my PhD was actually looking at the systematics of these species. So we did a combination of morphological and molecular characters for species. So the morphological aspect was to capture as many characters across the skeleton as possible to compare the fossils to living species, and then molecular data was incorporated from 6 different genes found in living birds of prey that could then constrain the living species into an accurate phylogeny, because if you just had morphology alone, you get a lot of
Errors sometimes.
Yeah, you get quite a few errors.
If you have two lines of thinking, it just kind of, I guess, it just constrains things a little bit better.
Yeah, I think.
Is my understanding. Yeah. I have no idea about molecular stuff because I just work on things that are purely extinct, been extinct for a long time. So
I think homoplasy is a good way of putting it. So you get inaccurate relationships between species that are morphologically very similar, but genetically aren't that close.
Okay. And so I guess it's like a vetting system then, in a way, against convergent evolution.
Yeah.
So sometimes things will look the same because they're doing the same thing or they're occupying like a similar ecological niche. But then, as you said, that process kind of accounts for that and then stops things that are pretending to be each other from grouping together.
Yeah. And that was actually a very common thing back in the day, because in the family called Accipitridae, which is all eagles, hawks, and what we call old world vultures, so vultures that are today found in Europe, Africa, and Asia,
as opposed to the New World vultures, which are in the Americas.
Yeah, so the New World vultures in the Americas are actually a different family altogether.
Yeah,
so the Cathartidae.
They're not related, really, but they're just doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's actually two subfamilies of vultures in the Accipitridae, the Japetinae and the Aegipinae, and they're not even directly related to each other. So scavenging behaviour has clearly emerged twice in this family. And back in the day, before molecular data came along, these two subfamilies were traditionally often mixed up together because they're so morphologically similar to each other.
And then if you went from one area to the next and you saw something that looks really similar from the outside doing the exact same thing, you'd logically come to the explanation that, oh, they're all related. They all had a common ancestor. But no.
Yes. So anyway, based on the phylogenetic analyses I did, Cryptogyps seems to be related to the Aegipinae. So this includes species like the griffon vulture, as well as the Cinereus vulture and the leopard-faced vulture.
When do you think vultures kind of first got to Australia then?
That's a very good question, because obviously we have the fossils of this species to show they were definitely here by the late Pleistocene, but we don't really have the fossil record or fossils to show when they might have first arrived.
Mm.
So it's currently believed that vultures, based on the fossil record, evolved probably around the Middle Miocene.
Phew! Just wanted to let you know that the Middle Miocene is about 16 million to 11.6 million years ago.
So this was during a time when grasslands were expanding and quite a lot of animals were growing larger as grazers. So vultures seem to have evolved in response to that, to take advantage of, you know, this new resource that was appearing of large carcasses being left behind by these large species.
Yeah, the food source and also the grasslands, being able to go across a big area and scope out carcasses as opposed to trying to navigate like a really busy or dense woodland or something like that and trying to find carcasses that way.
Yeah.
Because they're pretty visual animals, aren't they?
Yes, they are. So theoretically, vultures could have been in Australia for millions of years, but we don't have any evidence to show if that was the case or not.
Yeah. I suppose the really exciting thing about your research is that now that you've sort of opened people's eyes to the fact that we have vultures as well, maybe more people will be keeping an eye out for it, you know, through museum drawers and things like that, and even on new digs.
Yeah, I actually had a thought, you know, going back to function for a moment. So we have fossils from a site called the Green Waterhole Cave, which is found in South Australia. So it's near Mount Gambier, which itself is very close to Narracourt. And so these fossils of the wing bones I mentioned, so the ulna and all that. And what they show is that Cryptogyps doesn't really have the what we call pneumatic fossae in its wings. So these are essentially
like holes.
Yes.
So they're for air pockets and bones.
Yes. And these are, you know, pretty much found across almost all living vultures today, but Cryptogyps seems to have lacked them.
That's super weird.
Yeah. So it's got us wondering if perhaps there was less efficient of a soarer compared to these birds. Again, there's that possibly a size aspect, because I did mention Cryptogyps was a bit smaller compared to most vultures today. So perhaps on that basis, it weighed less and so didn't quite need as much
pneumaticity.
Yeah. But I think some of the smaller species do have that feature though. And so I'd need to investigate that further to just check. But it might be, again, perhaps related to it being a more, we say basal member of the lineage. So it might be related to its position in the phylogenetic tree. There's a lot of funny things about it.
What other like little idiosyncrasies does this species have?
Yeah, well, in spite of its seemingly lack of soaring efficiency, it's found from Western Australia to New South Wales. So it clearly had no issue traveling across the continent.
Yep. Okay. So really getting around, doing the rounds. I believe at this time as well, quite a lot of megafauna are demonstrated to sort of have some migratory aspects, and they're getting around as well. So it could be following food source.
And actually, one of the most exciting things about the fossils at Green Waterhole Cave is that we could date them for an age.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah. So the fossils were buried in a sediment layer of calcite rafts. And so these are crystals of calcite that form on the surface of still bodies of water in caves.
Yep.
And so at the time, not long after they form, they sort of sink to the bottom of the pool. And so at the time, there was probably a pool of water in this cave. In fact, today the cave is almost completely submerged, but during...
Hence the name Green Waterhole.
Yep. But at the time, it would have been mostly dry with a pool of water lower in the cave thanks to a lower water table at the time. Yep. It was likely this pool of water that was acting as an attractant for animals to go into the cave. So Dr. John Hellstrom from the University of Melbourne was able to do some, I believe, uranium-thorium dating on these calcite rafts, which the fossils were buried in, and he retrieved ages of around 60,000 years old. So by proxy, that means the fossils buried in this sediment must be around the same age.
Yeah.
And so that gives us the youngest age yet for Cryptogyps, which places it basically right before the megafaunal mass extinction.
Yep. Were you surprised that there's no Cryptogyps after the megafauna go extinct?
Not really, no. It's easy to see how that sort of event would negatively impact a vulture, having almost all the large-bodied animals die out.
Yeah. It would be cool to have vultures in Australia, although it would also just make things very interesting, I suppose.
Mm.
And then did you just do the one paper on Cryptogyps, or were there a couple?
So I've had two papers dealing with Cryptogyps. So there was the original in 2022 that re-described it. Mm-hmm. And then there was one that came out a week and a half ago, which included this new fossil material from Green Waterhole Cave.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, another question that I was thinking of before. Is Green Waterhole Cave technically part of Narracourt, or no, it's just outside?
So no, it's technically just outside it. So it's near Mount Gambier in what was called the Tantanoola district. So it's a reasonable way away, but it's a part of the limestone coast area, essentially.
Yeah. The reason why I wanted to ask as well is because Narracourt has World Heritage Protection. So I was just wondering about sort of that side of things, I guess, too.
Yeah. Well, actually, I believe Green Waterhole actually had heritage protection given to it too recently.
I do worry about like the future of the fossils and stuff, and you know, whether work can continue to be done on these groups. And I personally love field work as well. So it's always nice when you know in the back of your mind that these sites are protected for future generations and more paleos will continue to do research on them. Have you gone out to collect any fossils yourself of like this or like the eagles that you work on?
So actually that relates to the eagle story.
Oh,
so
okay.
Yeah, so it was actually just after I finished my PhD in 2021. We went.
What a time to finish a PhD as well in COVID.
Yeah.
Did you get a graduation?
We did, but we had to make sure that we were, you know, socially distancing and wearing masks.
Well, that's good to hear that you at least had something to celebrate all the work that has been put into your research.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was in December. So we were actually looking for, so we went up to this site called Mayor's Cave, which is in the southern part of the Flinders Ranges in South Australia.
Mayor's as in a type of horse, or mayor as in like a person who runs a town?
So it's actually spelled M-A-I-R-S, so it's neither.
Okay, great. I'm glad I asked that because I will do a transcript of this later as well. So
yeah, so in my thesis, we had four bones from this site. So these came from a large accipitrid we knew was an eagle. And so my supervisor, Trevor Worthy, suggested, you know, we could go back there and see if any of it got left behind because these four bones were recovered over two trips spanning decades. And so he'd had quite a bit of experience caving and retrieving fossils from caves. So he'd have an idea of where bones could get left behind or overlooked. And we also had a good idea of the original location these bones had been found at because that had been recorded.
Was there any like overlap between the bones? Or is the idea that they all belong to one individual or no?
So these bones had all been found around the same location and we didn't have any duplicate elements.
Yeah.
So it was only four bones, but there was the thought that they might come from a single individual.
Okay.
So we ended up teaming up with the Flinders University Speleological Society to arrange a trip up there because they had access, of course. And
Speleological Society, I'm guessing, being caving
yeah.
and stuff? Yeah.
Yep.
Cool.
And so we were able to arrange a trip up there. Now, to get into Mayor's Cave itself, you need to descend a 17-meter drop.
Pew! And for my US listeners, that's a 55.8-foot drop.
So
how are you with heights?
I got over it.
Yeah.
We did a bit of training beforehand on abseiling and just getting down using ropes and things like that. So we got to go down into the cave. And so we were able to get to that location that had been recorded many decades before. So the thing with Mayor's Cave is that most of the floor is covered in rock. And okay. so that section of the cave is about, I think it was something like 30 meters in. And so that's mostly a large boulder pile. So you can you know, search amongst the boulders for fossils. There's some crawl spaces you can get into amongst the boulder pile itself to work your way down, see if anything's slipped between the cracks.
And at that depth as well, I'm guessing it's completely dark.
Yeah, you have to bring your own light. Yeah. So it's actually quite a spacious chamber. So the entrance chamber is quite broad.
Considerate of it.
Yeah. It's comfortable to walk around in, less so when you're crawling under the boulders, but otherwise they're fairly roomy, so claustrophobia is less of a concern. And so we got to the site thinking, okay, we'll probably find maybe a couple more bones. We're really hoping to find like some of the diagnostic ones like the tarsal metatarsus. And then we got there and we ended up finding 28 more bones from all from a single individual. So that's basically the
same one you were chasing, you reckon?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this included, you know, the tarsal metatarsus, some more bits of the humerus and the ulna, a bit of tibia tarsus shaft, quite a bit of vertebrae, and the cherry on top part of the skull.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so real blue moon event.
So you've spotted all these bones. What's it like to actually collect them? Like, do you have to put anything on the bones to consolidate or?
Pretty much.
Because so, I'd assume being fossil bird, they'd be pretty fragile. Like, would you just do that before you even like touch it or anything like that?
So most of them were not so fragile that you could handle them without fear of disintegration. But the main concern was, do they survive the journey back up out of the cave and then being transported back to the lab? Because it would be quite a journey in the car. So give them a good coating of paraloid and make sure they're packaged up nice and securely so that they're not jostled around, damaged on the way back.
Yeah, if you have to drive on a dirt road and there are corrugations, you don't want them to just rattle to pieces.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's talk about this eagle. It's Australia's largest extinct eagle.
Yeah, so size-wise, it probably would have been about twice as big as a wedge-tail.
That is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
That is bordering on something that can pick up a human.
Yeah, maybe not quite that big, but you would
Maybe if you're little, maybe if you're 4 years old.
Yeah, you'd want to keep an eye on your kids around it, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Phew! If this bird is double the wingspan of a wedge-tailed eagle, that's 5 meters, which is 16.4 feet. Just thought you should know. Let's get back to it.
Yeah, so we named this species Dinatoetus gaffi. So genus name literally means powerful eagle. And the species name was to honor Priscilla Gaff. So she did a master's thesis in fossil eagles as well. And she worked with the original four bones. So it was a way of, you know, paying tribute to her
efforts.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. So thanks to the discovery at Mare's Cave, we were then able to identify other specimens from a few other sites. So we had confirmed specimens from the Wellington Caves in New South Wales and from Narracourt Caves in South Australia. So that sort of suggests at least a southeastern distribution for the species so far.
How does it relate, I suppose, to the eagles that are present in Australia? Is it related at all, or is it?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. So this eagle is, in fact, it's not related to any species in Australia today, at least not closely. In fact, its closest relatives are, funnily enough, the Aegipinae and the Circassinae. The Aegipinae, of course, being a subfamily of vultures, and the Circassinae being a subfamily of eagles known as the serpent eagles. And so this group is primarily composed of small to medium reptile specialists. But I think more significantly, this group also includes a more unusual species for the group in the Philippine eagle, which is a large bird of prey that specializes in mammals.
Yeah, they're endangered, aren't
yes, they
are. As well? Yeah. Now the follow-up question has to be, what do you think Dinatoetus was eating? Because during the megafauna time too, there were some big snakes getting around.
It's very tempting to think of it as, a snake eagle, literally hunting snakes.
If someone wants to do paleo art showing those two, though, I won't be mad.
Yeah. Though I think it's probably more likely it was a mammal specialist because it had these quite sturdy, robust bones, which indicate physical strength, which is very important when dealing with prey that can struggle and put up a fight.
Mm.
And that tends to be more mammalian prey.
Okay. Yeah. I hadn't even considered that. To circle back to what you were mentioning with the pneumaticity or lack thereof in the vulture, I was like, that's weird. Why didn't you just do what birds do? But then there's a cost benefit. You have to weigh it up and sort of find that sweet spot where the bone is strong enough to deal with the stresses and the strains of not just flight, but hunting or scavenging, depending on if you're like ripping and moving things side to side, things will start to get stronger and more robust that way. And then, being light enough to fly.
Mm.
It's kind of like you can't make a plane out of all of a black box material because then it's not going to get up off the ground either.
So it's quite likely it would have been hunting, medium to large birds and marsupials. So you would have had, for example, the giant mallee fowl around back in the day. So the megapodes.
I have no idea about them. Tell me more. How big are they?
So some of them were considerably larger than the mallee fowl we have today. So I believe Progura narracourtensis is the giant one. I think that's up to 50% larger than the modern species.
Hey, it's Adele. So mallee fowl get up to 60 centimetres tall, or 2 feet, and weigh up to 2.5 kilos, or 5.5 pounds. Progura narracourtensis is estimated to be between 4 to 7 kilos, which is equal to 8 to 15 pounds. So a sizable snack for our giant extinct eagle. Okay, let's get back to Ellen and hear what else Dinatoetus might have preyed upon.
Also, it would potentially be maybe even certain species of kangaroos. In fact, wedge-tailed eagles today are known to occasionally prey on kangaroos.
I have seen two wedge-tailed eagles try, and I think they wanted to get the joey off a mum. This was when we were in Broken Hill. We were supposed to be mapping folds and faults when I actually did card rock geology, but we all just stopped what we were doing and were just so taken with this scene unfolding in front of us. And I think they've got like a bit of a preference, a bit of a soft spot for pink joeys as well, ones that don't have fur on them and stuff.
Yeah. And there have been documented attacks on, sub-adults.
Dogs even.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty easy to imagine that Dinatoetus would have had less issue being much larger, taking on those sorts of species. And given the species alive at the time, probably would have been targeting perhaps the juveniles and babies of certain megafauna as well.
Yeah. In terms of how it was taking them on, probably really hard to work it out from the bones, but I know a strategy some birds will employ is they just grab it, they fly up, and then they just drop it, let gravity do the work, maybe they can get some nice rocks to try and break it up a bit more. What can the bones tell you about how it hunted? Because you also mentioned you had part of the skull.
Yeah, well, we had the, what we call the neocranium, which is the back of the skull, so the beak isn't preserved. So that's a bit of a limitation. So the favoured tactic of most, you know, eagles is to actually, you know, they swoop down and they just sink their claws in. And the idea is to just get those claws in as deep as possible and cause catastrophic damage, essentially.
I should have remembered that because a mate of mine has, he works as a wildlife vet nurse, shout out Cesar Pushmaran. He has mentioned an instance when he was trying to treat an eagle and it just, and he had gloves on as well, but it just sunk through and just crushed. So they've got, yeah, really powerful feet.
Yeah. So this is in contrast to, say, falcons, which essentially fly in as fast as they can and hit their prey foot on. That can often kill it. And if that's not enough, they'll do the killing blow of their beak. So that's not really what eagles do. So instead, they're almost entirely just using their feet to kill their prey.
Do they often like go for the head then? Yeah. Or like the organs?
Yeah, so I think falcons typically target the head. They're usually preying on birds and other such things as well. So, you know, not quite Dinosaurus, but we do know one of the tactics of another extinct eagle, Hieratus mori, the giant New Zealand eagle.
Oh.
So we actually know from fossils preserved of moa from sites such as, I think, Pyramid Swamp, where there's actually preserved claw marks in the pelvis.
Oh, wow.
And so they think what they were doing is that the eagle would swoop down, one foot would close in on to the moa's essentially back, and then they'd reach around with the other foot to grab at its neck or head.
That is very metal. I'm also glad that I'm not around when this is going on, because moas were massive. But yeah, these birds are something else.
Yeah. Actually, again, with the eagles. So the paper describing Dinosaurus gaffii actually came out early this year. So would have been probably around, was it around March sometime?
Has it only been that long?
Yeah, okay. Not that long ago.
Well, the reason why I say that is because I went to Queensland Museum mid this year and they had their like revamped Dinosaurs Unearthed public exhibition. It's free to go. People should go. And I think they had on the wall Dinotoatus.
Oh, nice.
On the side. I'll try and find the photo and send it to you. But yeah, it was just really great because I knew it had been the last 12 months, but I think my perception of time this year has just completely gone out the window.
Yeah. So actually our paper that came out just a few weeks ago, besides dealing with cryptogyps, also dealt with some eagle fossils from Narracourt. And so these are Dinotoatus fossils, but they're not Dinotoatus gaffii. They're actually what seems to be a second species.
That's really exciting. Did you name a second species?
Yes. So we've named it Dinotoatus pachyosteus. So the species name literally means thick-boned because it's quite robust in its skeleton. And so this is actually quite surprising to us because initially we believed these fossils to come from the same species. And it was really only through close comparison of some of the specimens that we figured, okay, there's actually a few differences here that we don't think can be attributed just to difference in sex, because otherwise the bones were smaller than what we found of Dinotoatus gaffii. So initially we thought maybe it's just male and female, because birds of prey do tend to have a bit of a size difference between the females and the males of the species.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, in fact,
who tends to be bigger?
The ladies, actually.
Yes! Big mamas! Let's go! I was talking to Phoebe earlier this morning and she said the males in genuinus tend to be bigger. And I was a bit like, oh, okay. But the reason why I must have this preconceived notion about them not having sexual dimorphism in terms of size, because they'll co-parent together and they can be quite like, oh my gosh, egalitarian? A little bit.
Egalitarian.
Egalitarian, that's the one. The parents are good. They both contribute to raising the chick. We love to see it.
Mm.
So yeah, it's a bit of a surprise to me that there is size difference.
Yeah, I think in some cases it's been suggested that the size difference is particularly greater in species that primarily prey on birds. So it could be related to not having males accidentally kill female mates. So because from a biological perspective, it's probably more sustainable to have...
The success of the species will not thank you for killing members of your own species just because you want something for lunch.
Yeah. Although in species, for example, like vultures, there's still a size difference, but it's less pronounced. Whereas in something like some of the hawks or even in falcons, it can be quite significant. So females can be up to twice as large as their male counterparts.
Wow. Okay. I did not know that either.
Yeah. So if you see a particularly large wedge-tailed eagle, it's probably a female.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay. So, and then again, the second species of Dinardoides, it's showing this trend in smaller bones that are more robust. And was there like less pneumaticity, like less of those air holes as well?
Yeah. Or? So it's, well, the pneumaticity is particularly a vulture thing because they sort of are doing the thing where they're increasing their body size because having a bigger wingspan is better for soaring.
Yeah.
But at the same time, a bigger body also means being heavier. So the pneumaticity is to sort of help circumvent that a little. Whereas with these eagles, it's not necessarily the case. They're getting big, but they're not necessarily aiming to be, you know, specialist soarers because they might have their own restricted territories where they're hunting in. So they're not having to search far and wide for a carcass to feed off of, though, you know, many eagles do that anyway.
Yeah, in somewhere as vast as Australia, sometimes you can't just nick down to the shops to get a feed. Sometimes you have to actually search around for it.
So the fossils we have of Dinardoides pachyosteus, we have a humerus. So this is similar in size to a wedge-tailed eagle, but more robust and notably more curved in the shaft. And so what that indicates to us is that this is related to essentially the lever action of the limb. Okay. So in birds of prey, having a humerus with a straighter shaft means that you're not doing much flapping. So you're more likely to be a soarer, whereas greater curvature indicates you're doing more flapping. So you're probably doing more flapping flight, which might indicate you're living in an environment that's more heavily forested. So you're having to dodge through the trees a bit, or you're actively engaging in pursuit of prey rather than just soaring down from above to pick at a carcass.
Oh, okay. That's so interesting. I never made the connection between soaring being not linked to actively pursuing prey, but it made total sense when you said it to be like, oh yeah, if they see you coming, you want to be, you know, putting in as much effort as you can to chase them. You don't want to be like, oh, I'll just glide in. Here I come. So do you think in the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be more fossil vulture, fossil eagle stuff coming out of the works?
You can only hope.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the stuff I worked with came from collections. So it's my hope that, you know, more material will be found in these coming years, especially if people are more aware that these things existed. So fossils of these species are, you know, naturally quite rare because,
hollow.
Yeah, they're more fragile compared to mammalian fossils. They're going to naturally be less abundant in the environment compared to your more typical prey animals. And of course, a lot of these sites might not be the ideal place for these species to be in the first place. So the caves, for example, probably not a lot of them ended up in there to be fossilized to begin with.
Yeah, or maybe some that went in there managed to work their ways out. It's just that some didn't.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, Narracourt is a massive area as well with heaps of fossils and stuff.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to me because we have sites like Lake Calabona is this site where all these megafauna got bogged. And so my thought is, you know, maybe sometime in the future, it might be possible to identify perhaps feeding marks from fossils there, because a lot of vultures do leave subtle traces on the bones. The problem is they can be just mistaken for regular scratches. They're not distinct like tooth marks.
Yeah. What type of marks are they in particular? Like do you pinpoint them by where they are on a particular element or?
Yeah, so there's not a lot of research on this in like the paleontology area, but in some taphonomy works, you can sort of pinpoint areas where vultures are more likely to feed, particularly around areas that are meaty. So you might get a vulture that's reached in to grab a bit of flesh, and as it's doing so, it's scraping across the surface of the bone with its beak.
Yep.
And that can leave a mark behind. But it's just a matter of someone applying that sort of knowledge and trying to find those sorts of marks on the skeleton.
There's a lot of megafauna fossils in Australia. But yeah, in terms of, I suppose, going through hundreds of specimens, it would be quite a lot of grunt work.
And yeah.
If they're subtle again. But it's always interesting when we can use fossils and then work out the relationships between like extinct animals. But yeah, that's absolutely incredible to have Australia's oldest vulture, Australia's largest extinct eagle, another species of extinct eagle that you just weren't expecting to see. Is there anything else you wanted to mention about like the form, function, and family groupings of any of the species that we've covered? Or?
So I mentioned before, Dinartolatus' closest living relatives seem to be species in the Aegipinae and the Circassinae. The thing is that the Dinartolatus genus essentially is positioned basal to the clade behind Cryptogyps. So the three of them form a clade together that's basal to Aegipinae. So that's particularly curious to me because that could suggest that perhaps Dinartolatus was this very ancient lineage of perhaps basal Aegipines that might predate the specialization in the scavenging, or that they could be probably more likely they're more closely related to Circassinae, but the tree is interpreting them as Aegipine because they might have just similar features to the Aegipines that modern Circassinae happen to lack.
Yeah, okay. Like one or two features kind of pulling them one way when they should be more like another way.
And that's one of the things about doing phylogenetics with fossils. You know, there's always going to be
pitfalls.
Yeah.
Especially work.
Yeah, especially when you can't get molecular data for these species. It's not like you can get ancient DNA from your fossils like in Europe where there's permafrost, because we don't have that sort of thing in Australia. All our DNA specimens would have been completely denatured by the time we find them.
Yeah. Did you say that all the Australian stuff is grouping together? Mm. Could it be that maybe there's an endemic radiation of Australians, so maybe they all have a common ancestor? This is probably too much of a simplification. And I know with modern stuff, sometimes it's a case of going locally extinct, then a reintroduction like multiple times and all this weird convoluted stuff. But like biology is not simple either.
Yeah. Well, at least with the Dinartolatus genus, that would suggest something of the sort was happening because you know, to have two species during the Pleistocene, there must have been a common ancestor earlier. So that to me suggests endemic evolution going on at least in that lineage. So it's quite possible that the common ancestor of these species arrived hundreds of thousands or even millions of years beforehand in Australia.
Yeah. And then, sorry if this is a dumb question, but the extinct eagles in Australia, they're like not related to the extinct eagles that were over in New Zealand either.
No, it's a funny thing. So the extinct New Zealand eagle called Haast's eagle, scientific name Hieratus mori, its closest living relative is actually the little eagle in Australia. So they share a common ancestor that diverged about 1 million years ago.
That's very cool and a bit unexpected, but there are some similarities in the birds that we have in Australia and New Zealand as well. So yeah, other than that, where can people find you and get updates? Maybe when you have a new paper, like are you active on Twitter at all, or is it just best to kind of keep up to date with the Flinders University profile that you've got?
So I do have an account on Twitter. I'm not regularly active, but I do post updates on
I post and ghost to Twitter as well.
Yeah.
Like if people want to get onto me on Twitter, don't. But when I have a new paper, yes, I'll post about it on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can find my handle, Elenatus.
I had this with Phoebe as well. I love it when people have like a combo of their name and the group that they work on because it just tells me everything about them. So now that's absolutely awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge on birds. I've learned so much. And yes, again, it's really awesome to hear about mind-blowing, enormous giant eagles that used to live in Australia and vultures, which is just a group we don't have around at all. I got to see them in Brazil and they have like their own majesty about them. I say that probably because I was a good way away from them, so I couldn't smell them. But yeah, they're absolutely fascinating. And we don't have them here in Australia, probably for the best. But again, it's nice to imagine what it would have been like to see them, particularly scavenging on like big megafauna.
Yeah, Very cool. At the time they went extinct would have been a bit of a loss because as specialist scavengers, their extinction meant that quite an important ecosystem function was removed. So you would have had other species scrambling in to fill that niche. So particularly there would have been the Thylacine and the Tasmanian devil around at the time. And that could have certainly impacted like transmission of certain diseases because that's been observed in places like India where they had the vulture extinction crisis over there. And that resulted in an increase in feral dogs and transmission of rabies.
Yeah. Vultures, I think they get an unfair bad rap, but they really are like nature's little sanitation crew cleaning things up. And because you don't have, a carcass baking in the sun for however long, or if it's near water as well, contaminating the water, they're doing a good thing, keeping things clean. And as you've just mentioned, like when they're not in an ecosystem, things do get out of balance. Mm. But again, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure talking.
Shout out again to Dr. Ellen Mather for sitting down to chat with me about all her incredible research. I always knew eagles and vultures were really cool, but knowing more about these extinct species from Australia just gives me a new level of appreciation for them. There's so many cool things going on with them, so I just can't wait to learn more. This episode was also made possible with the Conservation Department at Museums Victoria, particularly Richard and Lizzie for permitting Pals and Paleo access to their recording studio. It made life so much easier, and I super appreciate it, and the other NMV folks who helped me connect with and record on site. Full transcripts of each episode are up online at palsandpaleo.com, and you can also buy stickers of our podcast cover art over there too. If you want to support the show in other ways, the biggest thing you can do is to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast app. That really helps us rank higher, get more information out there, and share facts on the form, function, and family groupings of cool fossils with the world. The podcast was edited by the always excellent Francie, who also came up with and sings our amazing theme song. You can find him on Instagram at FrancyPlanet and keep up to date with his solo project and his band at Hello Kelly Music. I'm a big fan of Hello Kelly, especially their album Sweet Nostalgia, so if you haven't already, go check that out. Our podcast cover art is by Jenny Zhao, one of the co-founders of Crumpet Club. You can find them on Instagram at JennyZDesign, or one word, or Crumpet Clubhouse. Thanks so much for listening. If you've listened to every single episode, I just want you to know you're my favorite human on the planet. I love you heaps. And if this is your first time listening to the show and you're keen to dive into the back catalog, welcome. And I can't wait to bring you more episodes in the future. Pals and Paleo will be back soon to talk about new discoveries and fresh facts on old fossils. But until next time, be kind to yourself and just keep digging.